Hi, this is Maria Olson. You may know me from Trophy Heads or Starry Eyes and maybe Paranormal Activity 3. And I want to welcome you to Anthony T's Horror Show because it's an awesome show.
Hi, my name is Jessica Cameron, and you're listening to Anthony T's Horror Show.
Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus, and you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to another edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. In this edition, I will have two interviews. First, next segment, I will be talking to Matthew Lawrence, director of a film called Covenant of Evil, which is available on DVD and VOD. Then after that interview, I will be talking to director Rich Mallory about his film Sinful, which was shot during quarantine. Plus, I will be talking about a film that hit number one on the American box office. That's right, a horror film that hit number one at the American box office this year. And it's not what you think. Seriously, it's definitely not the film you're all thinking about right now. Before I go into what I'm about to say, I just want to let everyone know that from this point on until the end of the segment, these are the views of my views only and not of the Doc Discussions Network, because I have a commentary over a news item that I'm going to get into right about now. Now, normally I would start with a couple of news items, but there is a news item I want to get off my chest, and this is more of a commentary. Usually during the news segment of this podcast, I would just talk about the news, but there is something that I really need to get off my chest. And it has to do with the latest Shudder announcement. They recently announced 61 days of Halloween programming block with 8 new original and exclusive films. This includes Color Out of Space, which is a very good film from Richard Stanley. So I'm happy that's finally getting onto that streaming service. You also have May the Devil Take You 2, which is the sequel to the 2018 film May the Devil Take You. May the Devil Take You 2, which is going to be hitting the streaming service on October 29th, 2 days before Halloween. You also got a Joe Bob Halloween special coming up October 23rd. I'm excited for that. But there is one thing on this list which I'm not excited for. So much so that I'm kind of pissed off at Shudder here, because this film does not belong on Shudder, because this film is an utter piece of crap. Now, my regular listeners to the podcast maybe know where I'm going here, because back on episode 44, I reviewed Glenn Danzig's utter piece of crap, quite frankly, because it is really one of the worst horror films that I have seen in years, Veronica. And I literally went on a 10-minute rant on this film, because this film is so bad, it's not even a guilty pleasure film. This film is a film that literally sucked the life out of me. I could go on and on about this, but personally, I'm not going to, because I'm going to re-air that review on a future Best Of show. Because this rant was, to me, for the ages. Because literally, this is the worst horror anthology film ever made. And guess what? It's coming to Shudder. And this is why I'm pissed off about it. I don't know who came up with the idea to acquire this film for the streaming service. Because Veronica is a horrible film. Why on earth, Shudder, you are putting on quite possibly one of the worst films in the last 20 years. Seriously. When I see Shudder, I expect good quality entertainment. I know some of the originals can be hit or miss, but this film is like a new low for bad films. Seriously. And it's really a crime that this film is on Shudder. Because there are some really good films out there that deserve the Shudder spotlight. Seriously. Because personally, these films should be seen. Not films like Glenn Danzig's Veronica. It's really bad when you see good films like Weird Fiction, Rootwood, and Sinful don't get that exposure that it needs to maybe find itself an audience. Because all these three underground horror films are very good. I enjoyed those films a lot. But it pains me when a crappy film like Glenn Danzig's Veronica gets put on Shudder because, wait for it, it's directed by Glenn Danzig. If this film was not directed by Glenn Danzig, this film would not be on Shudder. Seriously. Because this film is crap. And it really pisses me off that Shudder is willing to put out independent horror films from rock stars who can't direct and see the films that I just mentioned not get spotlighted on Shudder. You're not helping independent horror, Shudder, by putting on Glenn Danzig's Veronica, because that film is a piece of crap. If any other director would have directed this film, that film would not be on the streaming service. It is disgraceful that Shudder picked up Glenn Danzig's Veronica for streaming. It's like, oh look, here, we have a rock star. Why don't we pick this film up? Even though pretty much everyone that has seen the film has bashed it. Come on, Shudder. Seriously. I want to see films from up-and-coming independent filmmakers on Shudder. What I don't want to see on Shudder is films that are completely trash, like Glenn Danzig's Veronica. And I don't get why Shudder did this. Seriously. Because this network is a great network. But this does not fit the quality of a Shudder film. I'm sorry. Glenn Danzig's Veronica is 100% trash. It is why it's the worst film of 2020. And Shudder just puts it on because, you guessed it, Glenn Danzig's a rock star. So it must mean, oh, people will probably watch it. What you guys are doing is showing a film to people that they're probably going to hate. I sat through this film bravely, might I add, and I hate every minute of it. But since I was doing a review of this film for this podcast, I had to sit there and watch 90 minutes of boredom. I don't want this kind of quality on a network that I'm subscribing to. Well, I cancel my subscription? Of course not. But Shudder, come on! This is one of the worst films in the last 10 years! Why did you have to pick this film up for the network? It's just mind-boggling. It's rewarding bad filmmaking. Enough with this. Seriously, I don't know why Glenn Danzig's Veronica is getting a prime spot on Shudder and tens of very good independent horror films aren't. I don't know why Shudder would put this piece of trash on its channel. Enough with this. I'm probably going to go another 10 minutes if this rant continues. So I'm going to end this right now. Because seriously, Shudder, that was not a good move putting Glenn Danzig's Veronica on your network. Because the only reason it's on is that Glenn Danzig is a rock star. Besides Anthony T's horror show, you can also listen to these other fine podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. Doc Discussions, hosted by Philip Perrone and Michael Darwin. You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. Halloween Boutique, Psychotronic Reviews. And Searching for American Gods. You can find Doc Discussions on the web at www.docdiscussions.com. And Doc Discussions is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Every day there's a family struggling with hospital bills to care for their sick child who is fighting an illness. There's a woman who is fighting breast cancer and is having trouble making ends meet while paying for their treatment. And there are burn victims that are going through treatments to heal their deep wounds. There is a charity in the horror community that helps these people. Scares That Care is an organization that helps families deal with the bills for their child. They help women get the treatment they need to fight breast cancer, and they help people who are dealing with severe burns get the help they need to heal. Scares That Care is a 100% volunteer organization and 501c3 nonprofit charity that is dedicated to helping these people in fighting real monsters. To find out more information or to donate to Scares That Care, you can go to www.scaresthatcare.org. Every donation helps Scares That Care fight real monsters. Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with director Matthew Lawrence, whose film Coven of Evil is currently out on DVD and VOD. How are you doing today, Matthew?
I'm doing really good, thanks, Anthony, and thanks for having me on the show.
What made you want to get into the filmmaking business?
Well, I've been interested in films for as long as I can remember, really. As a kid, I always wanted to watch films I wasn't allowed to see. Many of these were horror films. Nightmare on Elm Street was one. In my local video store, there was a big cardboard cutout of Freddy. And he always terrified me, but kind of fascinated me at the same time. And being so young, I was never allowed to see it. And I guess part of the thrill of being a kid was wanting to see things which you weren't allowed to see. And that kind of made me get into horror. When I was a kid, some friends of mine and I used to make our own little horror films. Some of these were horror, some were kind of violent action films. And they had kind of funny names like Spooks Hotel and Cops New York and things like that. We made those on our parents' camcorder. And yeah, as a kid, I wanted to be a special effects artist. I liked practical effects and monsters, but I wasn't very good at making things, so that probably wouldn't have worked out. And also, like, Hollywood and the whole movie industry seemed very far away. So I never really kind of saw it as a career path. But when I became much older and filmmaking equipment started to become more affordable in the mid-noughties, then I started to consider making my own films. On the independent scene.
Speaking of the independent scene, what is the independent horror scene like in Britain?
Okay, so it is quite fragmented. I'd probably say it's quite small. There's a lot of people doing things separately. There's not like an industry, so to speak, of from what I can see. I've tended to find when I'm looking to get my films distributed, it often involves like working with a lot of distributors in the US. Predominantly. So it does seem quite small, but there are some good festivals. There's a lot of people that are interested in horror. So yeah, it's just it's just kind of very, I'd say, fragmented.
Besides writing and directing, you also run a production company called Macabre Pictures. How did you form that company?
Well, it was actually a friend of mine, who's best man at my wedding, a screenwriter named David Ross, and I that formed the company. And we really put it together because we were starting to work on our first feature film, Tied in Blood, and we needed a production company for that. So kind of that's the origins, really.
You have a new film called Covenant of Evil out here in the US. Tell everyone about the film.
Okay, so Covenant of Evil tells the story of a young journalist called Joe. He's trying to make a name for himself writing articles on witchcraft. And he gets invited to a ritual by Evie, who's the leader of a coven he's just written about. And once he goes to stay with the coven, he gets persuaded to join in one of the rituals. And then from that point on, he kind of finds that his own desires take on a darker nature. He also meets a young woman there called Alice, and he starts to suspect that she's being held there against her will. And gradually he gets drawn into her world of modern day witchcraft. So there's an element of folk horror about it. We've kind of drawn some influence from the likes of The Wicker Man and Blood on Satan's Claw. But it's more of a modern setting.
Covenant of Evil is your second feature film, as you've done some shorts prior to this film. What made you decide that this project was going to be your second film?
Well, how it came about, I'd taken a little bit of a break after Tied in Blood because I had a young family, and then I started getting back into filmmaking and doing some shorts. And I was talking to a distributor who had released my first film, Tied in Blood, and I was talking to him about my next project. And he really gave me a title, Covenant of Evil, and asked me to kind of pitch an idea for that title. So that's how the film came about, and it all kind of, things started moving from there, really.
What was the audition process like?
Right, well, we had quite a lot of good actors audition. So the first role, I guess, the first actor that I cast was for the part of Xander. And I pretty much wrote that with a character, with an actor in mind. There was an actor that I'd worked with called Craig R. Meller, who makes a really good bad guy. We get on really well. So I pretty much wrote Xander for him, although I didn't tell him that he still had to audition. But yeah, then the rest of the casting process, I think the most difficult role to cast was the part of Evie, who plays the High Priestess. She's sort of a femme fatale character. And the idea is she's supposed to contrast with Xander. So Xander's all like brute force, and Evie's kind of more scheming. So I actually wanted her also to contrast with Alice, who's her younger sister and a lot more innocent. So it's quite hard to find somebody that could play that role. So in fact, the actress that I ended up casting, Samantha Morehouse, she was quite a bit younger than I'd initially intended for Evie. In fact, she's kind of almost the same age as the sister Alice. So we did have people who auditioned that were kind of a little bit older, but I felt that Sammy was the better actress. And then, as well as probably another role that I should talk about is the role of Kizzy. So she was written as kind of like a hippie, dizzy-ish character, and she provides like a little bit of comic relief. And that was the take that the actress that I cast, Tracy Gabitas, gave me in the auditions. She was really funny, and I cast her pretty much straight away. But then as she was working on the character, it became obvious that there was a better way to play it. So the dizzy persona is just like a facade, and underneath she's a lot more serious and committed to what the coven are doing. So I like that. It kind of made the character more layered and interesting. So I had those three roles cast, and then the shoot ended up being pushed back because the actress who was initially down to play Alice dropped out. And then various other kind of actors had to drop out because of scheduling conflicts. So Craig, Sammy and Tracy were the only actors from the initial cast who sort of remained in place. So in the recasting, I cast John Thacker as Joe, and I like the way he plays Joe. Is very naturalistic. He sort of plays it in an understated way, and he's like the anchor for the audience, like a link to normality, and he watches as the rest of us watch as well as the madness kind of unfolds. And then opposite Joe, I cast Laura Peterson, and yeah, Laura's a joy to work with. She's like really well prepared. It was a tough shoot. We had bad weather, kind of long hours. It's physically demanding, but yeah, she was a trooper. She was really good. And then in the role of Talia, we cast Laura Ellen Wilson. And Tali is like kind of one of the newcomers to the coven, unlike the more established members who have like a special gift or power. She hasn't found her power yet. So I cast Laura, who's kind of a bit of a horror regular. She's been in some great indie horror films, films like Monster and Surprise and Next Door. And then we had like a great supporting cast as well. So I was kind of very lucky with the cast that we were able to get.
What was it like getting funding for this film?
Well, yeah, it was actually the way that the funding happened was quite rare for an indie film. So we actually funded it through pre-sales. So we raised the money by selling the distribution rights in advance. And that kind of thing doesn't happen as much anymore. I think I was only able to do it because I had a pre-existing relationship with the distributor who distributed my first film, Tide in Blood. So it's actually like a risky thing for a distributor to kind of give an advance to a film that hasn't been made yet. So the budget was had to be kept really low to mitigate this risk. So like, although I can't disclose what the budget was, it was like really low, especially for something that's got monsters and effects and things like that.
What was it like finding the main location of the film, as it looked like it was in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, so I tried to write the film around kind of resources and locations and things that I'd have access to. So I actually kind of grew up in Yorkshire, which has some really, really good rural locations. So the place where the kind of main ritual happens with those kind of big stones is a place called Brynestones. So I knew of that. I kind of grown up near there. So we used that as a backdrop, really.
What were some of the challenges filming at that location?
Yeah, so I think probably the toughest part of it was the location. It was kind of very high up, very cold, very windy. The weather kept changing and we had to kind of shoot around it. So I think that the actors found it really tough. You know, the conditions are quite hostile. So a lot of the places where we were shooting, actually, you can only get to on foot. So you kind of park as near as you can to the location and you have to haul all the gear and all the props and everything up there. And then there's kind of problems with sound. We'd do kind of recces and it'd be really, really quiet because the location is very remote. And then we'd come to shoot and it'd be very windy or, you know, people get wind of the fact that we're shooting and kind of have come along there. So there's all those sorts of challenges. But I think one thing that I'd say shooting in places like that is if you can put up with the hardships, you get a really good looking location for free.
I noticed that Covenant of Evil is your first screenplay that you've written. What made you want to try your hand at screenwriting?
Well, I was actually used to work with David Ross, who's like a friend of mine and kind of he was co-founder of Akar Pictures, and he wrote Tide in Blood, and we had like a great relationship, a good working relationship. And one of the things that David was able to do is very much write around kind of the restrictions and the resources that you have access to, and I think that's kind of key for indie films, really. And yeah, so David wasn't kind of available to do the writing for this. And like, I hadn't had as good an experience working with some other writers because they weren't able to kind of just write around those resources and restrictions and kind of really base the idea around what we had. So it just came about from there. I kind of had some of my own ideas around the title that was I was asked to pitch for. And I also kind of knew the restrictions and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to try writing the screenplay with those things in mind.
What was the process like writing this film?
Well, I actually follow quite, I guess, a conventional screenwriting process. I don't like to start writing the script until I've got everything nailed down. So I start with writing a little synopsis, and then I develop my characters. And the actual process of writing the character sketches can change the story quite a bit, because the characters' motivations and things play into that. So once I've got the characters written, an idea of the story, I then kind of work out the structure and I have like little post-it notes and I tend to move them around like pieces in a jigsaw and trying to see what's going to fit where. And then once I've got everything in place, that's when I normally write the first draft. And I'm quite quick with the first draft, and then I'll take a break and come back and do various rewrites or various different iterations. So I'd often find that I'd try and set some time aside each day to do some writing, but sometimes the ideas wouldn't come when I was trying to do the writing. They'd come in the middle of the night, and then I'd get up and start writing again. So,
how do you come up with the characters of the coven in your main character?
Okay, so I guess the main character came about in the pitch, and the same with the character of Alice, because I wanted it to be about an investigative journalist. And so that's kind of about with the pitch, and I wanted him to be quite young, quite naive. And then he decides to try and save a woman that he meets at the coven, which is Alice. So then when it came to fleshing out the members of the coven, what I wanted to do is try and make them quite modern and make them almost kind of be trying to figure out the whole process of witchcraft and that sort of thing, and kind of almost fumbling their way through it a little bit in some senses. So the first character I came up with was Evie, who is kind of like a femme fatale and quite kind of a seductress and a very, very scheming. And then I wanted a character that contrasted with her. So her husband is Xander, and he's kind of all brute force, really. And then I started developing some of the other characters. So we had Kizzy, who was meant to provide some comic relief and is a little bit kind of ditzy and dizzy, and she kind of contrasts with some of the others.
Did you do any research into witchcraft before writing the screenplay, as it had a gothic tone throughout, as is talk of forces during the course of the film and other witchcraft-like imagery?
Yeah, so basically I did do some research into kind of modern day witches and Wicca and that sort of thing. But I didn't really want the coven to be like that, because as the clue was in the title, Coven of Evil, we wanted them to be kind of a very evil coven. So kind of what I tried to go with is that they present themselves as like a Wiccan coven, but they're actually Satanists. So we had the kind of like the classic, you know, kind of devil worshipping and that sort of thing. And that's really what kind of transpires.
The film also has a couple of disturbing scenes where a character is getting hit with a belt, which came off as a little disturbing, in my opinion, given today's climate. What made you want to include those scenes as part of the film?
Well, I think probably one of the things, because it's like a lower budget film, so we're having less kind of demons and creatures and that sort of thing, a lot of the horror has to come from what the characters do to each other. And I think sometimes the things that people do to each other in kind of real life is more horrifying than kind of some of the old tales of like mythical creatures and those sorts of things. So that's really kind of how that started. And I think part of the character arc, I guess, for Alice is that she's kind of very much controlled and dominated and abused by Xander, really. And then she eventually learns to kind of take control and, you know, stand up for herself. And then I thought it was quite fitting as well that she very much kind of saves herself at the end rather than waiting for somebody else to kind of come along and save her.
How did the US distribution deal with worldwide media distribution come about?
Well, I was actually talking to the executive producer, who's a guy called Warren Croyle, and he's got a couple of distribution companies, and he put out my first film, Tide in Blood. And we'd kept in touch, and I was talking about ideas for our next project. And then he gave me a title, Coven of Evil, and asked me to pitch an idea for it, which I did. And then it just came about through that, really. We basically raised the finance through pre-sales. So we kind of already had distribution in place when we started shooting.
What are some of the differences dealing with American and European distributors?
Really, like, if I'm being completely honest, I haven't really dealt with, I only really dealt with Warren. So he's distributed both of my first two films, and then he kind of handles that, really. So yeah, I probably couldn't tell you in great detail.
Has he come back to you with some notes from the distributor on your films?
No. I mean, he is kind of the distribution company, he kind of, in this film, he was involved in the development process, and he gave me some notes on the script and that sort of thing. But yeah, no, he hasn't come back to me since the film's been released with notes or anything.
I also found out that you have a new short film out on the Covenant of Evil Facebook page called The Ghost of Hope House. Tell everyone about that short film.
Okay, so that's a little ghost story about a young girl called Claire who goes to look for her granddad in an abandoned building, and what she finds when she gets there is kind of a little bit horrifying. So how that came about, there's a good friend of mine who's a director of photography called Jamie Burr, and he had access to this great location called Hope House, which was being renovated, and asked if I wanted to kind of do a little film around there. So because we had access to the location, I wrote a little short film to make use of it, really.
What is it like filming in that location, given the fact that it's being renovated?
Well, it actually wasn't too difficult, because we had it to ourselves. There was like a time period where we had to shoot, like a certain window that we had to do the shoot. So it wasn't too difficult. We didn't have anybody else there. It still had electric and that kind of thing. It looked kind of probably more in a bad state of repair than it actually was. So yeah, it was just a good location, and I think we're quite lucky to have it, really.
What was casting for the film like?
Well, I actually put out a casting call. I always put out casting calls on Mandy.com and had a number of actresses apply. But for the lead role, I actually chose to work with an actress who was in Coven of Evil, Alana Marie, who plays the girl sacrificed at the beginning in the kind of the prologue for Coven of Evil. So I think she's a very talented actress, and we've worked kind of well together. So I was happy to cast her in the main role. And then we had some great actors for the supporting roles as well.
What made you want to make a transition from this witchcraft to sinister ghosts in the story?
I think it was just the location itself lent itself to that kind of tale, because we wanted to make a short film. And I just thought when I went around to have a look at it, that's just what spoke to me. It just seemed really spooky and really creepy. So we thought to go with that angle.
Which type of filmmaking do you prefer? Feature films or short films?
I think feature films are more satisfying, ultimately, because they feel like more of an accomplishment. And you can get to work with the cast for a little bit longer, with the crew for a little bit longer. So I kind of prefer feature films. That said, I do find short films fun, and they're kind of a good place to experiment in a way that you can't always do with feature films. You can kind of take chances and that sort of thing.
How can people watch The Ghost of Hope House?
Well, it's actually available on my Vimeo channel. So I'm on Vimeo as Matthew J. Lawrence. So if they search for me there, they'll find The Ghost of Hope House.
And also on Facebook as well, on the Coven.
Yeah, on Facebook. So, yeah, I'm actually on Facebook, Vimeo, and YouTube as Matthew J. Lawrence. I'm on all three there. Yeah, so they'll probably find it on either Facebook or on Vimeo.
What are some of your upcoming projects?
Okay, so I'm actually working on a short horror film called Look Deeper. I should say I'm in development on it, so it's not kind of started pre-production yet, but I have written the script. And that's about a man who's spending the night with a married woman, and then a husband comes in. It's going to be a dark and twisted film, and it doesn't resolve in the way that you'd expect. And we actually intended to give the film a very stylized look. We're drawing influence from some of the giallo films, like particularly some of Mario Bava's work, like Blood and Black Lace. So it should be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to it. I think things have kind of been pushed back quite a bit because of the current climate. But I think after that short film, I'm going to probably be developing another feature.
Where can they find you, your films, and Macabre Pictures on social media and the web?
Okay, so the website for the production company is macabrepictures.com. I'm on Facebook, Vimeo, and YouTube as Matthew J. Lawrence. And I'm on Instagram as Matthew J. Lawrence Films.
I want to thank you for coming on my podcast, Matthew. Have a good day and stay safe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I'm the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well, then look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John! Now for something new and improved!
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
This is Carrie.
This is Billy.
This is Mr. Bo.
And we are from A Podcast from Beneath. You can catch us every Wednesday wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with writer-director Richard Mallory, as he has a new film called Sinful Out, which you can find on Amazon Prime. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for inviting me on. This is a lot of fun.
Now, how did you get the idea that you wanted to be a filmmaker?
Always. Like, even as a little kid, I would, like, kind of make my own movies in my head, and I would just play act them out in the backyard. I think I, you know, originally wanted to be, like, a movie star, probably like every other kid, and realized that wasn't the path for me as I got older, and kind of just fell into it. I was, you know, moved out to L.A. and was looking for a job, and a friend of mine needed help on set, and I had nothing to do, so I pitched in as, like, a script supervisor, and once I was on set, I was totally hooked. Just loved the energy and the process, and just really dove right in, just working on whatever I could.
Tell everyone about your new film, Sinful.
Sure. Sinful is a, I would say, LGBTQ-themed psychological thriller. It focuses on these two lovers that committed a horrific crime, and they're on the run hiding out in this house. They're waiting for their partner to come bring them new identities so they could leave town. But, you know, the house has different ideas, and we learn a lot of secrets about, you know, some of the horrific things they've done, and go through pretty much a downward spiral of sex, drugs, and violence. And I don't want to give away any of the twists or anything like that, because it's definitely one of those films that you really have to think about and kind of piece together. But yeah, it's you know, real exciting film, real thrilled with it.
How did the idea of the story come about?
So it really came about due to the quarantine that we're all feeling right now. You know, a lot of us are trapped in our homes, and, you know, a lot of us are, you know, either are afraid to go out or just can't go out for various reasons. So I started thinking about, you know, what would happen if, you know, you legit were trapped and couldn't leave, and you were in the house with another person, and kind of, like, what would happen? Like, would you kind of turn on each other? Would you start getting on each other's nerves, like, if you were trapped long enough, and started feeling claustrophobic? So I started thinking about that, and kind of just how fragile the human psyche is, and what could happen. And so I just had these two characters basically in a room just thinking about what they would do. And then, you know, an idea came, well, what if they had done something terrible, and what if there were some other things at play? Kind of really just took it from there, but definitely inspired by a lot of the things that are going on right now.
So it's basically safe to assume that the screenplay was written also during quarantine?
Yeah, so I was actually getting ready to shoot a different film called The Hunted, like a much bigger production, and we were about 2 weeks from starting, and that's when the stay-at-home orders happened. And, you know, I was really bummed because I was very excited about shooting that film. Like, I can't wait to do it. And Gregory Hatanaka, who's someone I work with a lot, he was shooting this other film during quarantine. And he said, look, we have equipment. We have a set. Like, you know, if you can pull something together and you want to shoot it, you know, be my guest. So as soon as he said that, I got the laptop out and just started writing. I wrote the script in probably about less than a week, and then we shot it.
What made you want to make this story more of a psychological horror film than a traditional horror film?
I wanted to do something different, something that you hadn't really seen before, or at least hadn't seen in a very long time. You know, I watch a ton of horror movies, and, you know, I'm a huge horror fan, but I really wanted to do something different with this movie. And, you know, I was trying to think of what you could do if you had just, you know, only two characters. One of the limitations we had due to the quarantine was, you know, we couldn't have a lot of people on set. You know, we really wanted to limit the cast, limit the crew, limit the locations. So I was trying to think of what you could do with just two people, and really kind of thought about, you know, the story's going to kind of be told by, like, what these two people are going through. So I really wanted to kind of get into their heads and into their psyches. And, you know, it just became really, you know, psychological, with a bit of a Twilight Zone, Black Mirror kind of edge.
One of the unique things about this film was the fact that the two main characters are an LGBTQ couple. What made you want to explore that angle in a serious way and put a heavy emphasis on the relationship?
Sure. So when I write, I tend to write more female characters than male characters. I've always just found that more interesting and more dynamic. You know, the whole, I've done another film, Sociopathia, a few years back that had a lot of LGBTQ themes. As I mentioned, my movie, The Hunted, that I was getting ready to shoot also has those themes. I just, I felt like those relationships can be very, very complex when you have two females together. And I feel like that's kind of also like their own kind of like underdog, you know, they're all, you know, kind of something that's a little not as traditional, you know, something that people might struggle with and struggle with getting behind. So I don't know. I just gravitate towards those kind of tales kind of often.
The film also explores the emotional psyche of these main characters. What made you want to explore their state of minds as one of your main focuses?
I think I just, you know, when we were making the movie, like, really, I mean, you're focused on these two people. I really wanted to kind of get to know them and really kind of just show kind of their descent into madness as the story kind of goes. If you watch the movie, like, there's definitely like a claustrophobic feel to it. You definitely can kind of feel kind of what they're feeling, and the actresses that we cast, we both did an amazing job of kind of portraying that. But like, a lot of the story kind of comes together as you're watching it, and you really kind of have to like think and, you know, kind of piece it together. So there's a lot of like just nuances in the performances that you might not pick up on at first, that, you know, afterwards you might think and like, oh, I thought it was odd how they played that scene that way. But then as you kind of get more into their heads, it all kind of makes sense.
How did you settle on your two main actresses, Nicole D'Angelo and Christina Loh?
So Nicole, I've worked with in various projects throughout the years. I've never directed her, but, we've co-written together. We've produced together pretty much like throughout my entire career. When she was filming this movie, Quarantine Girl, that she was co-directing and starring in, which also shared sets with Sinful. So it was very easy to kind of get her to kind of like rap for her day and then kind of come over and do Sinful. And it was amazing because I always wanted to direct her. She's great and really, really gave an exciting and energetic performance. Christina had starred in one of Nicole's movies, Acrylic, that she shot right before the quarantine. And it's a much different movie. It's a comedy about a nail salon. Really, really fun, cool movie. But Christina, like, steals a lot of the scenes in that. And I wanted to see if she could do something darker. And she happened to be available and killed it. You know, both actresses really had no time to prepare because once the script was written, we were basically shooting it a few days later. But they both really gave it their all and just completely kicked ass. They just rehearsed the hell out of their scenes, and when it was time to go, they were ready to rock and roll. So I loved working with the both of them and really can't wait to work with them again.
How much rehearsal time was given to those two actresses, as I thought they were very good in this film?
Yeah, actually none in advance, but on set, you know, there's always downtime, and sometimes, you know, people will sit on their phones during 10-minute setups or hour setups or lunch. And not Nicole and Christina, like, we said cut, and while we were getting ready, they were rehearsing behinds. They were going over it again and again, you know, and again, they nailed it. And one of the reasons why that was great was because we had a really limited time to shoot this, you know, because of like the limitations. We had 4 days to shoot an entire feature, which is crazy. So there wasn't a lot of time to do a lot of different takes. And also just because of safety, like, we didn't want to have masks off for long periods of time. So, you know, they needed to really nail everything in one or two takes, which they did. They were very prepared and really dug into the roles and were just very open to direction. And, you know, they gave the performances that were needed to sell this movie, because it is all about them.
What precautions did you and the producers put in place to keep everyone safe while filming?
Lots of sanitizer. The crew, which was three people, we kept it really, really limited. You know, so we had less than, you know, five or less people on set at any time. The crew all wore masks throughout the set, which was really, really challenging since we shot in Santa Clarita and it was literally 100 degrees every day. So, and we couldn't have the AC on because of noise. But, you know, we all wore masks. We just cleaned and, you know, did the best we could to stay distance from each other. But again, we really, the main thing we did really was just limiting the people on set. You know, it was myself, a DP, a camera op, and a producer occasionally, and then the two actresses. So, you know, there really wasn't a lot of interaction with people.
What was it like shooting this film compared to shooting a normal film?
Well, so you know, the presence of COVID definitely like played its own character. Definitely hung over the set, right? And just kind of, again, limited us in what we could do, but it made us think a lot more strategically, you know, like how can we get it shot as much as possible in a limited amount of time? Like how can we shoot this all in like one location? To me, having the really small crew really helped us work fast. You know, on a normal set, you know, you're waiting on makeup, you're waiting on lights, you're waiting on this, you're waiting on that. And, you know, things take way longer than they should. But because it was only a handful of us, we were able to just kind of bang out our scene, move on to the next one, bang out that scene, move on to the next one. You know, everything worked really smoothly. But at the same time, while we were working really fast and hard, like it was just a really relaxed atmosphere. You know, having more people just adds more stress. It's just more personalities, more people to chase and be worried about. And, you know, I've been on some sets that were just a nightmare, and this was like such a pleasant experience. It got me excited about filmmaking again.
Would you consider shooting with a limited crew again for another project in the future?
Yeah, hell yeah. I wish I could shoot everything with a limited crew. Unfortunately, you know, a bigger movie needs more, right? If you want to have like effects or, you know, blood or certain things, you need more people. But yeah, I am really excited about to shoot another one like this again. Gregory Hatanaka, who I mentioned earlier, and I were discussing like some things that we could potentially shoot next month. I have a few scripts that I'm kind of like tooling with to see if we can kind of pare down and shoot another movie really quick while we're still under lockdown.
What was the budget for this film?
I'll be honest, I don't have the answer to that. I don't really, at least for this movie, I didn't really touch any of the money, so I don't know. I'm very small, but I also don't want to say that because, you know, I want people to watch the movie as a movie and not think like, oh, this cost that. But it was definitely probably the smallest budget I've ever worked with.
Understandable. Tell us about the set in which you filmed Sinful Act.
It was one of the production team's houses, which made it really easy. You know, luckily, I don't want to say whose house, but they gave us access to the house, and it was, we had full reign of the entire place, which was interesting because I wasn't that comfortable with the layout of the house when I was writing the script. So like when we actually got there and I actually saw how things were located, you know, I had to make a lot of different changes and say, okay, wait, like this is that bedroom, and kind of like really had to kind of move things around quickly to kind of adapt, but can't really complain.
What was the atmosphere like on set, given the fact that this film has a more serious tone?
So we all really get along like really well. Like it was a really good group of people. Everybody was really laid back, but once we started for the day, it was kind of a lot all business. Like, you know, everyone kind of just, we didn't really take a lot of time to joke around. We kind of just put our heads down and just shot. So there wasn't like a lot of time to do anything other than shoot, which was great because it allowed everybody to kind of keep that same intensity, throughout. We also shot a lot of this linear to the script. So, you know, the performances kind of build as they normally would. And I think that was really, a lot of that's attributed to kind of, you know, doing scenes in order. And because we were shooting in a house, it was very easy for us to move room to room. You know, we could just pick up our light and move here and pick up our camera and move here. So we were able to kind of shoot things in order, which again, like I said, it really kind of, even though the movie is not exactly a linear movie, the way the performance is built, I think is a real, you know, could be really attributed to kind of how we shot it.
Why did you go for a non-linear approach for this film?
I wanted something that was more of a puzzle, something that you really had to kind of think about and piece together, something where when you're watching it, certain things don't make sense exactly, or you're a little kind of, something will trigger something in your brain where you're just like, wait, that makes me uncomfortable. I don't understand that. But then comes together later. So I really wanted to have the story kind of unfold in that way. It plays very linearly, but it's not exactly meant to. And I don't want to give anything away, but if you watch it, hopefully you'll see what I'm talking about.
Another thing that I liked about this film was that it had a claustrophobic feel to it with the way the film was shot. What was the film shot on, and what did you and your cinematographer do to give this film a claustrophobic feel?
So, I don't know if really, like, the technique is what made it claustrophobic, or it was really kind of the performances and kind of that we were kind of shooting in some tight spaces. I mean, we're in a house, not a set, right? So it's like there's only so much room in each room. But we wanted to shoot like on lenses that made the film more cinematic. So there's a lot of, you know, really tight shots, which I think really kind of helped that claustrophobic feel. Like you do feel trapped. You do feel like you're in there with them. And again, I think it's just kind of just, a lot of it is just really the performances and just kind of, you know, tricks of like camera placement and things like that really kind of sell that. You know, we also like aren't always like showing the whole world. We're showing a very compact space a lot of the times. You know, I personally am not a huge fan of master shots. You know, you get them and then you barely use them in the edit. So we didn't really shoot as much like on the wide like that. We kind of like really just dove in.
What was the most difficult scene to film?
I think the love scenes are always the most difficult to film, especially when you're shooting like without a lot of time. Like usually you take like an entire day or a half day to get everybody comfortable and to kind of block it and to kind of make sure everybody's good. But we didn't really have that luxury here. We kind of had to say, okay, you know, we gotta get this, and we have like an hour to do it. Also, we shot those scenes on the first day, which is, you know, not exactly the first thing people want to do, is get really intimate and, you know, shoot a scene like that. Usually you want to kind of like get a flow going and, you know, really get to know the other actor that you're doing that scene with, but we just didn't have that luxury. So those are always difficult. And even more so, but again, Nicole and Christina were amazing. Like they did not hesitate and just kind of, you know, really, really went for it and, you know, followed every direction. And they had just a natural chemistry too. And I think also it works in the movie that things are a little bit awkward, even kind of like a sex scene, right? I mean, if, you know, you don't really know it, but like they're dealing with something really crazy here, and they're kind of using sex as kind of a distraction from the guilt that they're feeling. So, the nervousness and the anxiety of it, I think, is really helps the scene also.
What's your favorite moment on set while making this film?
My favorite moment probably is when we wrapped and just being like, wow, holy shit, we actually got this movie done in 4 days. It was all a big bit of a whirlwind, but I don't know if there's really a good story or something interesting that happened. I mean, it was, again, we shot a movie in 4 days, so, you know, it was really just work, but... but fun work. I mean, it was such a laid back atmosphere. Like we all worked hard, but there was no stress. It was the first set I've ever been on where I didn't have to yell. I didn't have to like flip out on anybody. It just kind of like just went with it. So all in all, it was an awesome experience.
How long were the days?
So typically on a film set, you're doing 12 or more hours a day, but we probably only did like 9 or 10 a day. And a lot of that was, part of it was that Gregory and Nicole were also shooting a different movie at the same time, so they kind of had already done a few hours of work before I even got there, you know. But also part of it is we didn't want to keep people on set longer than needed to be. And you know, normally like I work on a movie and I get no sleep and I'm doing crazy days and then I get sick, and now's the time to keep your immune system up. So we didn't want anybody to be overworked and compromised.
What was the quick turnaround from completion of physical photography to the finished product?
Yeah, so and this was like a first for me too, is, you know, we wrapped it, you know, in May and took about not even a month to edit it, and then it was up on platforms in July. You know, I think we just really wanted to just get this movie out and get it out now and, you know, be able to kind of like recoup some of the money so we could start making more movies. But yeah, it was a very quick turnaround. But again, it's also motivating to have that tight deadline, because otherwise, like, I will tinker with a movie forever. You have to tell me what day you need it, or I will always be trying to fix scenes or make things better. So I believe we had an editor work on it for about a week or two, and then I think I had like a week to kind of polish it, add the music, finish it up, and then we were good. We were up.
Sinful is currently available on VOD. Will the film eventually get a DVD release?
So yeah, we actually are hoping to do a Blu-ray on it at some point, probably in the very near future. I have to talk to the producers about that, but I believe the goal is to get a Blu-ray in the market for people that want to have it.
Where can they find the film on VOD?
So right now, it's on Amazon Prime. It's there for rental or to stream if you're a Prime subscriber. I believe it will be up on Tubi TV where you can watch it with ads, in the next probably month or so. But right now, the only place to see it is either Amazon or I think you could rent it on Vimeo. But definitely Amazon.
What are some of your upcoming projects?
So the movie that we sidelined, that I was talking about earlier, The Hunted, is a movie I'm very excited about. It's kind of like a Eyes Wide Shut, but with an LGBTQ and BDSM angle. So I really can't wait to get going on that, again, once things are safe to shoot again. I have another movie, Coven, that we're in pre-production on, that, again, we'll have to wait until it's safe to shoot because it's a little bit more ambitious. That's about kind of like a home invasion with witches. And then, you know, there's a film, Darling Nikki, that I wrote and produced. We started working on this movie about 9 years ago. It's a very trippy Alice in Wonderland, erotic type movie, that we're finishing up editing now finally. And that'll be up on Amazon probably in the next, month or two. And then I'm digging through some scripts, trying to see if there's something that we can do in September. I have a few ideas, so we'll see.
Where can they find you and the film on social media?
So you can find me on Twitter at Rich Mallory, RichMallery. The film doesn't have any website or social for itself, but feel free to hit me up anytime.
Rich, thank you for coming on to my podcast.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Stay safe.
Yeah, you too, and support independent horror.
For the latest news and information on Anthony T's Horror Show, you can check out Anthony T's Horror Show on his social media platforms at Anthony T's Horror Show on Facebook, Instagram, and the Slasher app at Anthony T's on Twitter. Anthony T's Horror Show can be found on YouTube as well at youtube.com/AnthonyTherber. You can find Doc Discussions on the web at www.docdiscussions.com, and you can find Anthony T's Horror Show on the web at anthonytshorrorshow.blogspot.com. What's Anthony T watching? Well, at the top of the show, I told you I was going to talk about a film that hit number one at the box office this year. Now, all you mainstream horror fans were really excited for me to talk about either The Invisible Man, which hit number one for 1 week, or the most recent horror release, The New Mutants. Well, sorry, mainstream horror fans, because really, I am not going to go talking about either of those films. Granted, I haven't seen any of those films, but this is a podcast that tends to go more into the independent world of horror. I'm talking about The Wretched. That's right, IFC Midnight's The Wretched. The film has spent at least 5 weeks on top of the U.S. box office ever since the film was released back on May 1st, and had a theatrical run of $1.8 million. That's right, a film that spent over 5 weeks at the top of the box office only made $1.8 million, mostly due to the current pandemic, as this film was released mostly in drive-ins. And the funny thing is, Hollywood kind of tried to cover it up. Because if you go on to boxofficemojo.com, you notice after the third week, The Wretched hit number one at the box office. They pretty much stopped reporting numbers on their site because this film was at number one for 5 weeks. And it's amazing that Box Office Mojo doesn't want you to know it. And I don't really think Hollywood wants you to know it either. Because this is ridiculous. Seriously, let the film enjoy the fact it was number one for 5 weeks or so. But anyway, let's get on to the review of the film. Because personally, we could be here all day. And I don't think I want to be here all day because I really want to talk about how good this film is. The Wretched is a very creepy and intense film. One of the main reasons why I really think this film is very good is the fact that this film has a very good direction from the Pierce brothers. Both Drew and Brett Pierce do a very good job making sure everything in this film has this creepy, gothic vibe throughout. Because this is one of those films where it's one of those slow burn type of horror films. But still, this is a very good film from start to finish. It is a very creepy film. Very intense film. One of the reasons why I like this film a lot is the way they both set the tone from this film. Whether it's in their direction or their screenplay. This film had this very creepy and gothic vibe throughout, which really, I think, makes this film very enjoyable to watch, as I really had a very good time watching this film, as this film literally creeped me out at times, which I think helped made me enjoy this film a lot, quite frankly, because this is one of those films where it's the typical slow burn supernatural horror film, but one of the reasons why I think this film does a very good job also with the slow burn is the fact that I think they create a very good lead character in the film, as I like how they take their time into getting to know the main character of the film, because the Pierce brothers really do a good job making sure you get to know the character, that you're interested in the character. And that's what you need in a slow burn horror film like this one. And it pays off, definitely, towards the end of the film. Because I was very interested in this character. And I was very interested in the whole dynamic between the main character and the relationship that he has with his father. It really made the character worth watching. And another thing that I really think that the screenplay does very well is the fact that this film does a very good job in building suspense. This is a film that really does its job when building and building to the creepy finale. I like how the Pierce brothers approach the film's tense scenes here, as they had a edge to them, which is very needed in a supernatural film like this. It really made some of the most intense scenes in the film work so well. And it also helped that this film has a great score from Devin Burrows, as this score really feels like another character in the film. It really creates this atmosphere of gloom and doom, which is needed for a film like this to succeed. And this score here really helps this film go up a notch. Because in a horror film, you need a good score for a film to work. Especially in a supernatural horror film. Because in supernatural horror, you need a score that is on par with the film's screenplay. And the film has that. It has a very good score, which really made the film very creepy. And really, I think one of the better scores for a horror film this year, as the score in this film really makes the atmosphere very gloomy, which is a key component in what makes this film work. Definitely check out The Wretched, because it's a very creepy and intense supernatural scare fest that will keep you on the edge of your seat to its final minutes. Definitely check out The Wretched on Blu-ray, as this is one of the most frightening supernatural films I've seen all year. There's a lot of major things happening on DocDiscussions.com. Not only you'll be able to find my podcast, not only will you be able to find Doc Discussions podcast, you'll be able to find new podcasts on the network, including A Travel Guide to Lovecraft Country, which is a podcast devoted to HBO's Lovecraft Country. Other podcasts joining the network include Cut to the Chase podcast, Beyond the Screams, His and Hers Movie Podcast, Slashcast, Speaker Brain Podcast, and much more. You can go over to DocDiscussions.com for all the podcasts that are on the Doc Discussions Network. Next episode will be episode 50. It's amazing that I've made it to 50 episodes. Seriously, because when I first started out, I never thought I would make it to 50 episodes. But I did. And for my 50th episode, I will be bringing on cult filmmaker J.R. Brookwater, as we're going to talk about the re-release of Ozone, as that film recently made its Blu-ray debut. I've hailed this film as the greatest shot-on-video film ever made. That's right, Ozone was shot on VHS tapes. We'll talk more about that next episode. But it is the greatest film to ever be made on VHS tapes. I'll talk with JR about that next episode and much more about Ozone. That will be episode 50. Episode 51 is currently up in the air. I haven't decided what I'm doing for episode 51 yet. It could be another guest, or it could be a best of. As usually around this time, I usually do a best of show, but I haven't done one yet because, well, this podcast is going on all major platforms, so I want to focus on putting out new episodes. So I haven't decided what episode 51 is going to be yet, but it could go either way. It could be a best of, or it could be another regular episode. With that, I want to thank you for listening to my podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to Anthony T's Horror Show on Apple Podcast and Stitcher. Please leave a rating. And don't forget to subscribe to Anthony T's Horror Show. With that, I want to thank you for listening to this episode. Have a good day, stay safe, and support indie horror.